This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Today's speaker was Dr. Jens Ludwig, who is the McCormick Foundation professor at the University of Chicago and the director of the University of Chicago Crime Lab. The Crime Lab was founded in 2008, and the University of Chicago and Dr. Ludwig partner with policymakers in Chicago and across the United States to develop programs that will help to prevent crime and violence and reduce the necessity to flood areas with police officers that cities cannot afford to budget to have a strong dent in the crime rate. Dr. Ludwig said there's a basic inequality of basic safety that's just as important as inequalities in income, and we must address these projects. Homicide victims. In Chicago, there's been a tremendous increase. 2014, 490. 2016, 769. And just this past year, 650. So we see a 15% decline. Dr. Ludwig isn't certain what caused this decline, but he thinks a lot of it has to do with the fact that the police department is using their information and intelligence in ways that they never had so that they can predict where the bad guys are and where crime is likely to occur. There's been a large increase in gun arrests in areas like Englewood and West Garfield, but many positive interactions he found to be very encouraging. The willingness of police to record their stops and more positive interactions with the general public and developing programs that will deal with the very small percentage, about 5,000 people in Chicago, who his statistics indicate are responsible for 17% of the gun-involved crimes in the city of Chicago. The problem will not be easy to solve, but he believes Chicago may have turned the corner in reducing high crime rates.
Thank you very much to the City Club for having me here today. Thanks also, everyone, for coming. What an amazing turnout. It looks like a Trump rally. Oh. Is it too soon? I tell you what, I will make it up to you by using the best words. The best words. So what I want to do is talk a little bit about what has been happening with crime and violence in the city of Chicago over the last few years, what we understand about why that's been happening, and what else we, the city, collectively might be thinking about doing to address this problem. And then I want to make sure I leave plenty of time at the end for question and answers, because I know, as evidenced by the terrific turnout, I know this is an issue that many people in this room and all across the city care about, and so I want to make sure we have time for conversation about it. So let's get to it. This is a graph that shows the number of homicide victims year by year in the city of Chicago going back to 2010. And what you can see is from 2010 through about 2014 or 2015, we saw the sort of normal year-to-year variability in homicides that you tend to see in cities of about Chicago size. And then a very sharp increase occurring almost instantaneously at the end of 2015 of about a 60% increase in homicides from 2015 to 2016, which I think is historically unprecedented for a city of Chicago size to experience such a massive and instant change in such an important social condition. And what we can see now with hindsight that 2017 is behind us is we've seen a decline of about 15% in the number of homicides in the city of Chicago in 2017 relative to 2016. That's 119 fewer people killed at the hands of other people in the city. That's still up about 160 versus 2015, or up 230 relative to 2014. So let me just pause for a second to think about what these numbers mean. I was at a meeting. We have a tendency to talk about crime in Chicago and trends as a sort of counting exercise. I was at a meeting right before this lunch where someone made the observation in a different social service context that every number or data point is a person talking. And so I think it is fitting on the 5th year anniversary of the Hadiya Pendleton killing in Kenwood, right around the corner of the University of Chicago, to remember that every single number and every data point on this slide is a family that is completely devastated. And at some very, very deep level, one tragedy like this in the city of Chicago is too many. One. I think the news accounts tends to focus on the homicide numbers year to year in the city of Chicago. I think it's also very important to keep in mind that there are literally thousands of people in the city of Chicago every year who are scarred by gun violence. These are the survivors. And the patterns that we see year to year in non-fatal shootings tends to mirror very closely what we see in fatal shootings. And so you can see we had about 1,000 fewer people who were non-fatally shot in Chicago in 2017 relative to 2016. Now, if you look at the relative changes now in gun homicides and shootings, you notice that there's a larger decline in the number of non-fatal shootings than there were in the number of fatal shootings. And if you think about the implication of what that means, what it means is that in 2017, the lethality of shootings in Chicago increased relative to 2016. And I don't think we know, or at least I don't know exactly why that is. There are various hypotheses. Those of you who are reading the newspapers, I'm sure, have the same impression that I do, that the prevalence of rifles in shootings seems to be going up. That's something that's been very hard for us to see in the data, but it's a hypothesis. It's also possible that there's been some sort of change in circumstances of shooting. But whatever the underlying reason for it is, it's clearly a worrisome and sobering pattern. And I think the other thing that you see in the data, which I think is worth noting, is, if you look at the crime data in the city of Chicago, there are literally 100, 200, 300,000 crimes that happen every year. A large share of these never get reported to the police, but literally hundreds of thousands of crimes. And if you look at the total volume of criminal behavior that's occurring in the city of Chicago, that is not really changing very much year to year. So the dramatic ups and the modest declines that we're seeing from 2015 to 2016 to 2017 is not a massive change in social conditions more generally, or a dramatic change in the willingness of people in Chicago to engage in law-breaking behavior. What we are seeing are big changes in, the willingness and ability of people to use firearms against other people. It is a very narrowly channeled thing that we are experiencing in the city of Chicago right now. And that is the thing, I think, that is the key public safety priority in the city. Now, for those of you who are longtime Chicago residents, you will remember what it was like in Chicago in the late 1980s as the crack cocaine epidemic swept over the city. And you will remember what Chicago was like over the course of the 1990s. In the 80s, a rising crime tide basically lifted crime everywhere. And in the 1990s, as crack receded and a variety of other policy responses went into effect, crime receded almost everywhere. That is not the pattern that we are seeing in 2017 relative to 2016. So this is a map of the city of Chicago by neighborhood. The darker the blue, the larger the reduction in homicides in 2017 relative to 2016. So the good news here in this map is you can see that there are enormous reductions in homicides in Chicago, particularly concentrated in the Englewood, West Englewood neighborhoods. That's here on the south side of the city, and then in the Garfield Park neighborhoods on the west side. But the other thing that you can see in this graph is that the pattern is not uniform across the city as a whole. We see a number of counter trends here to the decline in homicides on the far south side of Chicago and scattered across the west and the south side for reasons that we do not yet understand. And another counter trend that we see in the city of Chicago is the increase that we've been experiencing in the number of carjackings in the city. And one of the things that you clearly get a sense from reading the newspapers is that that these carjackings are much more evenly distributed across the city of Chicago compared to the gun violence itself. And we can come back and talk more about why that is and its implications during question and answer. So I think those are the encouraging trends and the worrisome counter trends that we're seeing. And so let me turn next to my second question, which is, what do we know about why we're seeing these patterns in Chicago from 2015, 16, and 17? And so one natural starting place, I think, is to wonder what is going on with social service budgets by the state or by the city, and whether that might be a candidate explanation for the year-to-year variability that we're seeing in gun violence. And as far as we can tell from the data that we can access, that doesn't seem to be the case. So you can see there's some increases and decreases year by year in, this is social service spending by the city. Other education or social service spending data that we have tell a similar pattern. We don't see nearly dramatic enough changes in social service resources, at least as far as we can measure, to make this a plausible explanation for very much of what we're seeing in the year-to-year trends in gun violence. The other sort of hypothesis that you might have is that maybe there is some dramatic change in what the police department is doing, and I think the natural place to start there is to look at what's been happening with arrests by the Chicago Police Department. And so what we've been seeing over the last several years is a long-term gradual decline in the number of arrests that the Chicago Police Department makes every year. And you can see, in 2010, the police department was making something on the order of about 14,000 arrests. And by 2016, that was down, you know, in the neighborhood of half of what it had been as recently as 2010. And that really did not change in 2017. So what we are not seeing is a break in trend from the long-term decline in the number of arrests that the police are making. So what is going on? There are lots of things that could be going on. We've spent a lot of time at the crime lab looking through the data that we could assemble, and it's been hard for us to isolate very many things that we can see in the data that have a causal contribution to the decline in 2017. But let me tell you about the one thing that we have been able to find some evidence for. Now, I don't want to claim that this is the only thing that has been done in Chicago since the gun violence surge that matters, but this is the one thing that we've been able to identify in the data, which is a very important distinction. And that has been something that's been going on with the police department, I think people have been reading about in the newspapers, but I just want to spend a couple minutes talking you through what it is and what we've seen in the data that we have. So one of the things that the department has been doing is essentially trying to change the degree of data-driven police management in some of the most dangerous neighborhoods in the city of Chicago. And I think in the city of Chicago has many challenges. One of the assets that we have that I think I didn't appreciate initially myself is that the Chicago Police Department's IT infrastructure is unusually good by the standards of police departments across the country. Certainly much better than the police departments, the other police departments that we tend to work with in other cities. And I think that's been a very important piece of infrastructure that's enabled the department to do this. And so one reporter I was talking to described this in some sense as CompStat on steroids. Essentially what this is, it's you could think about it as data-driven police management emanating from the districts themselves with the goal of trying to put police resources in those places and times where gun violence is most likely to occur, complemented by a variety of data and IT supports, things like additional cameras and shot spotter technology, which is directional microphones that can tell when gunshots go off. And I think, interestingly, and I'll come to this in a second, in at least some of the districts, an expansion of the sort of metrics that CPD districts are using for their management dashboards, including things like positive community interactions. And so this started in February 2017, So this is something that the Crime Lab has been working with Chicago Police Department, the mayor's office on, together with Sean Malinowski, who's the chief of staff for the Los Angeles Police Department, where they've been innovating a lot of these changes. And this started in February 2017 in the two neighborhoods that in 2016 were most strongly affected by the gun violence, in Garfield Park on the west side, District 11, and Englewood, District 7. I think we have the commanders from CPD from District 7 and 11 here with us today. And let me tell you then what we are seeing in the... And so since then, the strategic Decision Support Center innovation has diffused to all of the Chicago Police Department Tier 1 districts, all of the most violent districts in the city. Let me show you a little bit of data about what we're seeing for District 7, Englewood, initially. So these are data on quarterly shootings in Englewood, and the solid dark line here is the actual numbers for the Englewood District 7. And you can see that there's a lot of up and down quarter by quarter, which is seasonality, more gun violence in the summer than in the rest of the year. And then what we did is we can use the statistics that we have on crime in other districts around the city to find other districts that follow a similar shooting trajectory to Englewood. And that's the dashed red line that you can see here. And you can see that the comparison districts actually do look very similar to Englewood. The pattern up through February 2017, both the level and the trend are very, very similar. Okay? And then we can ask ourselves, to what degree do the shooting data in Englewood diverge with these comparison districts that didn't get the SDSC intervention in February 2017 when Englewood's SDSC went live? And what you can see in that case is there is some seasonality in the Englewood data, but sharply muted compared to what you see in the comparison districts. This is about a 35% reduction in shootings in the city of Englewood. This is hundreds of additional people who are not scarred from gun violence in 2017 relative to 2016. This decline in Englewood itself accounts for about 15%, by itself, about 15% of the citywide decline in gun violence. So this is a huge deal for the community of Englewood and for the city of Chicago. I think then that leads to a question of what exactly is going on with these SDSCs that would drive down shootings like this. And I think one hypothesis that you might have, certainly one of the first hypotheses that we had, was maybe what's really going on is that it's not the SDSC management technology. It is the Chicago Police Department flooding the zone and pouring additional officers into Englewood. And that's not what we see. So we have a variety of different data sources, and we're not seeing an increase in police manpower or person power in the Englewood district. It seems to be instead some change in police practice, what the police are doing. And I think that is an incredibly important point for the following reason. If you told me that shootings in Englewood were down by 35% because CPD had sent an extra 1,000 cops into Englewood, I would say, on the one hand, that's great, because Englewood, if you are a mom trying to raise their kids in Englewood, you want the city to be doing anything that it can to control this problem. But that is not a very scalable solution across the city. We have 22 police districts. Where are we going to get 22,000 additional cops, if that's what was going on? I think what is encouraging is that changes in police practice are much more scalable than changes in additional resources. And so that, I think, is one very important thing to take away from this. Now, the other thing that you might wonder is, well, citywide, you've shown us that arrests aren't down, but maybe what happened in District 7 is that is the counter trend to the larger city trend. Maybe Englewood is arresting its way out of the gun violence problem. And that doesn't seem to be what's going on either. If you look at the trend in all arrests in Englewood, it is following the downward trend that we see throughout the city. So the police are not reducing gun violence just by arresting more people and exacerbating the other criminal justice problem we're all worried about in Chicago, which is incarceration. So what is going on in Englewood? One of the things that we see in Englewood is an increase in arrests of a very particular sort, gun arrests. And this is relevant because the problem that we're most worried about in the city of Chicago is gun violence. And so this is a plausible candidate for what might be going on in Englewood. Changes in police practices and management is putting officers in a position or incenting them in some way to get more illegal guns off the street. There's a second thing that we see in the data that is a plausible hypothesis, which is, you know, one of the technology complements to these strategic decision support centers in Englewood and the other districts is to try and use more and more data to predict where crime is going to happen and try and concentrate police officers where we think the gun violence is going to occur. So thanks to Chief Lewin and the department, we were able to get GPS data on police cars in the different districts. And so we can map the intensity of police GPS pings throughout the city. So these, the ping frequency changes a little bit from 2016 to 2017. So this is not quite as clean as one would like, but I think you see a very suggestive pattern. So the more intense the yellow, the higher the frequency of GPS pings, or put differently, that's where police are spending relatively more time. And what you can see is the left is 2016 in Englewood, the right is 2017 in Englewood, and you can see that there's a noticeable increase in what I would call focused patrol of police cars in Englewood on the main thoroughfares in the district. And so I think that's a second plausible hypothesis for what might be going on in Englewood in particular that's driving down gun violence. And here I think is the very intriguing third hypothesis that we see in the data, which is, so this is information on positive community interactions. So police can fill out a form when they have a positive community interaction with someone in the neighborhood. And, you know, once you put this on the dashboard, there's surely some two things going on. One is presumably a greater willingness of police to record the positive community interactions that they're doing, and potentially also a change in the willingness of police officers to engage in positive community interactions. So what we can measure is the combined effect of those two things. The red line here, the dashed line, is February 2017 when the Strategic Decision Support Center in District 7 in Englewood goes into effect. And you can see a very large increase in positive community interactions by police officers in Englewood on the south side with residents of the neighborhood. The other gray line here that you can see, these are positive community interactions in the other districts that got strategic decision support centers. And what you can see is that there's an increase in positive community interactions in the other districts as well, but that arises with a lag. Okay, and the reason that that's relevant is because when we're looking at the success story that we're seeing with this police practice in CPD is most clearly identifiable in the data in Englewood so far. So it's harder to see the same sort of very strong causal evidence for big impacts like this in the other districts, but I might say yet, right? So to the degree to which it's changes in things like positive community interactions that might be the driving force behind the reductions in Englewood, if that were true, I think we would be optimistic about what we would see from the other SDSCs in the future, given their delayed increase in positive community interactions. It's also the case that the technology supports were slower to come to some districts than others. And so I think all of us who live in Chicago and care about the city of Chicago, I think we'll want to hold our breaths and hope that the other SDSCs wind up being as effective as the one that we see in Englewood. Or more generally, think hard about what we can do to ensure that that happens. Okay. Let me now turn to the third category of things that I wanted to talk a little bit about, which is what else we might be thinking about doing beyond what we've been doing for the last couple years. And the way I wanted to talk about this was to start off thinking a little bit about what our goal might be in thinking about what else we might want to do. And so, as I showed you in the graph before, we are The number of gun homicides and shootings in the city of Chicago is down from 2016, but not down dramatically. There is no guarantee that we will get down to 2015 or 2014 levels. It would be a real accomplishment for the city of Chicago to ensure that we get down to where we were in 2014 or 2015. I think as I was reflecting on this, I wondered whether that wasn't, even that wasn't selling our ambitions too short. So I think this graph is very sobering in many ways, but encouraging in some other ways. So let me tell you what this is. This is a graph of homicide rates per 100,000 city residents in Chicago, Los Angeles, and New York. So here's the first thing that is really striking about these. If you've been to any of these cities over the last few years, here is the most striking initial thing from this graph, which is these three cities had nearly identical homicide rates in the early 1990s. So you can say, well, Chicago, it's so different from New York, which is different from LA, and on. But the fact is that in 1991, 1992, the violence problem, the gun violence problem in Chicago and New York and Los Angeles were really not that different. They really weren't that different. You can see up through about 2014, 2015, the city of Chicago had made pretty good progress. It's about a 50% decline in homicides. Much of that has been eroded away with the increase we've seen over the last couple years. But notice how much further homicide rates have dropped in Los Angeles and New York City, right? These cities are, so New York City's homicide rate right now is actually below the national average. It is 3.3 per 100,000. We are something on the order of 8 or 9 times the homicide rate per capita of New York City right now. So that is simultaneously sobering, but also in some ways encouraging, right? What's encouraging about this is that it lets us realize this is what is, New York and LA in some sense demonstrate to us what is possible to do in a city with 300 million guns floating around in private hands. In the early 1990s, many people would have just given up that there was much that we could do on this problem. And I think in some sense, this shows us what is possible. Now, let me spend a minute talking about what LA and New York did to get their homicide rates down there. If you look at the criminology research and talk to experts, oh, sorry, let me mention one other thing that's striking about the difference between Chicago and those other cities. This breaks down homicide rates per 100,000 in 2017 into non-gun homicides per 100,000 and gun homicides per 100,000. So the gray part of each one of these bars is the non-gun homicide rates in these cities. Notice how similar the non-gun homicide rates are between Chicago, Los Angeles, and New York even today. And notice that literally all of the difference and the number of people whose lives are lost to homicide year after year in this city, almost all of this is due to firearms. This is the problem that the city of Chicago is wrestling with. Now, if you look at what the experts think happened in Los Angeles and New York, that's usually told as a policing story. In New York City, in the 90s, they increased the number of police from 30 to 40,000 by way of benchmark. The whole Chicago Police Department is not much more than 10,000 police officers, call it 12 or 13, so that's a huge change, plus a bunch of innovative changes in police practices like CompStat. Los Angeles is usually told much more is about a change in police practices per se, without a big infusion of resources. I think one of the questions that you want to ask in thinking about what is actually possible in the United States is, what were the collateral consequences of relying so heavily on policing in these two cities at large scale? So I've shown you what can happen at modest scale in Englewood. What happens when you try and drive down lethal violence in a massive city relying so heavily on policing? And so I think there are two intriguing graphs that go with the LA and New York stories. And the first one is from New York City, where The gray line here is the violent crime rate over time in New York. And the fascinating companion line here is the incarceration rate in New York City, where you can see that as crime rate is falling in New York City, they're also driving down the incarceration rate simultaneously, right? This is the golden equilibrium that I think whatever side you are on in the criminal justice political debate in the United States, this is the outcome, the combination of outcomes that you want. Less crime and fewer people behind bars. And I think similarly, one of the intriguing graphs from Los Angeles is that at the same time homicide rates were dropping so dramatically, community approval in LAPD was increasing. If you were paying attention to the political campaign, the presidential campaign in the fall of 2016, these two things were posed as intrinsically in opposition. Either you send the police out to bust heads and lower crime, or you live with a society out of control. And I think what's so intriguing about the LAPD experience is that it shows, at least in principle, it is possible to get out of that box and reduce crime and improve relationships with the community at the same time. Okay. Now, of course, Chicago is different. Of course, Chicago is different. And one of the ways Chicago is different, and this was actually one of the ways Chicago is different, is that our social conditions are not anything like those now in New York City and Los Angeles. So we are not just the most segregated city in America, but the level of concentrated poverty that we have in our neighborhoods is unlike anything in Los Angeles or New York. You will not find a neighborhood like Englewood in terms of its economic deprivation. You will not find a neighborhood like Englewood. You will not find a neighborhood like Garfield Park and on anywhere in Los Angeles or anywhere in New York City. The only places that you find neighborhoods this disadvantaged in the U.S. are in places like Baltimore, Detroit, St. Louis. Other cities that you will be familiar are also wrestling with the gun violence problem in the same way that that we are. And when you look within the city of Chicago, as everybody in this room unfortunately knows, the gun violence is concentrated exactly in those neighborhoods that are most disadvantaged. And so I think for the city of Chicago, surely we want to be thinking about responses that also are responsive to these social challenges that we have in the city. And because poverty is so strongly linked to gun violence across our neighborhoods, I think an initial place to start is to think about how we address those economic challenges. Now, I want to start off with some initially daunting numbers. If you look at the data on who's involved in gun violence, either as offender or victim, you can see that this is very strongly concentrated between the ages of, say, 15 and 30. That is about one quarter of the Chicago population. Okay? And, you know, when I go out and I look at the most promising social interventions, like intensive jobs programs that really are intensive enough to be responsive to the severe need that many people have, it's not hard to design a promising program that easily gets up to about $30,000 per person very quickly. Now, I'm an economist, not a doctor, but I would encourage you, for your mental health, do not multiply 700,000 times 30,000. Do not do that. I am still suffering from having done that calculation myself last night. Okay, so this is a depressing slide. Here's, I think, what gets us out of that box. The Chicago Police Department, as I said before, is unusually good by the standards of police departments in the U.S. in terms of their IT infrastructure. What one can do is look at the available government data, and we can identify those people who are at highest risk for gun violence involvement. So we can identify 5,000 people who are at greatly elevated risk of gun violence involvement in the city of Chicago. 5,000 divided by 2.7 million, that is 0.2%, 0.2% of all city residents in Chicago. That group of people is involved in fully 17% of all of the homicides in the city of Chicago. Okay? Now, this is amazingly good news from the perspective of designing a social policy response. Because what it means is that in order to achieve population level reductions in gun violence, we do not have to give a $30,000 intervention to 700,000 people. Much as everyone in this room wishes we could afford to do that, right? What it means is that we can find 5,000 people to give a $30,000 intervention, and if we think that that might cut their risk of gun violence involvement in half, all of a sudden, you've reduced gun violence in the city of Chicago by, like, call it 8 or 9%, okay? Albeit at a cost of $150 million, which is a lot less than multiplying 700,000 times 30,000. Okay. Now, what you also, what's also, I think, worth noting with this is you can only push this strategy so far because it becomes increasingly difficult. The risk gradient or the risk curve for gun violence involvement flattens out very quickly. There are diminishing marginal returns, unfortunately, to our ability to identify those people who are at really highest risk. And so trying to target becomes incredibly expensive very quickly. So this by itself is not going to be the only way out of the gun violence problem. I just wanted to mention two other things, and then I'll stop and I'll take questions. So there are many, many other things that one could point to. This is not going to be the only solution. Many things we could point to. I just wanted to mention two. So this is not intended to be a comprehensive list. So one thing that is really striking is this came when we were doing the predictive analytics for who's at highest risk for gun violence involvement. Fully 60% of that 5,000 group of 5,000 people have a documented history of involvement with domestic violence in the past. Now, one of the things that we know, maybe the thing that we know best about domestic violence is that it is massively underreported. Massively underreported. If 60% of that group of 5,000 people have a documented history of domestic violence involvement, I think the actual rate of involvement must be 90% plus. And I think this is something, there are many other things that we need to be worrying about in the city of Chicago, but this really struck me when we were looking at the data, and I think this is something that we don't spend nearly enough time thinking about. And in the same spirit, the one other thing that I wanted to mention is, you know, the gun violence problem, it's a Chicago problem, and I think that naturally focuses attention on what the city of Chicago is doing. And so I think it is worth keeping in mind that the context of the city of Chicago also plays an important role in shaping the volume of gun violence here. So this is a graph of the share of total K-12 spending that is provided by state government across the country. So each gray bar here is a state. And you can see the nationally about 46% of all K-12 dollars in the average state comes from state government as opposed to the local government. And some of you might know what's coming. Yeah, I would orient your gaze more towards the left than to the right of this graph. Chicago is dead last. We are about 25%. We are dead last. So let me just do a quick calculation for you. Bringing Chicago up to the national average, that would be about $1.7 billion additional dollars in school support for CPS. That would be a 29% increase in our budget. That would increase, the best available social science suggests, that would increase our high school graduation rate by about 20%. And given the social science evidence on the link between high school graduation and gun violence, that would be about a 30% decrease in the homicide rates in the city of Chicago. For something that has absolutely nothing to do with the city of Chicago policies. Okay, so let me close now with one final thing, which is I want to try and paint a picture of an illustrative plan for what getting us closer to New York or LA might look like. I don't want to claim that this is should be the plan or that this is the best plan, but it's an illustrative plan to help fix ideas and illustrate a couple key points, and then we'll go to Q&A. So what I've done here is I've shown you my best estimates for the costs of three of the things that I just talked about. So the thing on the left is trying to find the 5,000 people at highest risk for gun violence involvement and provide them with a very intensive jobs program. That would cost about $150 million, and that would, right here, this is dollars on the left y-axis, and this is percent drop in homicides in Chicago on the right. That would get us about a, this is about an 8% drop in homicides. My best guess is that building out the strategic decision support centers to all of the districts in Chicago might cost us, call it on the ballpark of another $50 million. If we can get the average strategic decision support center to be even half as effective as Englewood, that would get us about another 20% reduction in gun violence. So key point number one from this is I think we really do need a balanced approach to addressing this problem. Neither social services nor policing alone are going to be able to push us all the way down to, I think, anywhere near New York or Los Angeles. And if we got school finance change in Illinois, that would bring $1.7 billion into Chicago and reduce it another 30%. This ambitious plan, so one thing to take away from this is not a crazy plan. This is not a crazy plan, right? It is feasible to begin to imagine what very large changes in gun violence might look like in Chicago. That's thing one. Thing two is it really will have to be a comprehensive plan. We are not going to be able to find any magic cure, single magic cure for the gun violence problem in the city. I think the third thing to say is that this will, given the dollar amounts on this graph alone, so if we could do all three of these things, this would still leave us with a homicide rate about three times New York City's. We would need more on top of this still, okay? Which highlights that we really require a great seriousness of purpose in addressing this problem. A great seriousness of purpose, which I think is fundamentally important for two reasons. One is, you know, we spend a lot of time in the United States talking about inequality in income. I think we don't spend nearly enough talking about inequality in something that's even more important than income, which is basic safety. I think solving this problem is fundamental to the most basic dimensions of fairness in American society. I think the second reason is gun violence is an incredibly powerful lever in depleting cities of population. We've done a calculation at the crime lab that if the homicide trend in Chicago had followed New York's trajectory, we over the last 25 years, we'd have something between 600,000 and 700,000 additional people living in the city of Chicago today. That is a big change in a city that is currently about 2.7 million people. So feasible, but seriousness of purpose, this will be a big project for all of us to try and tackle together. Thank you very much. Oh, thank you. Thank you for my radioactive drink.
Thank you, Dr. Ludwig. I think that was really quite an eye-opener of a presentation, some incredible ideas put before us. And now we have time for questions. Alex, I see you have some questions from... This is Alex Cawley, a member of our staff. Thank you, Alex. We'll try to get as many of these in as we can. This is from Barbara Norrish, concerned citizen. Recently, the Hyde Park, Kenwood, Indian Village neighborhoods have experienced an uptick in carjackings with guns and armed pedestrian robberies. What accounts for this? How is CPD addressing this? And what can residents do to be safe?
The first thing to say is that carjackings are up. I live in Hyde Park on the south side of Chicago, and it certainly got my attention myself when I opened my University of Chicago security alert to see a carjacking at 8:30 in the morning at the BP around 53rd and Lake Park. We're seeing an increase in carjackings all across the city. So, you know, there are maybe a couple things to say about this. One thing to say about this is maybe an unfortunate thing to say, which is we had a 60% increase in gun violence in the city of Chicago from 2015 to 2016. but it was concentrated on the south and west sides of the city, in the most disadvantaged neighborhoods of the city. And it was very easy to spend a lot of time downtown or on the north side of the city and not feel like there was very much going on. So it's been interesting to see the very different kind of public response to the increase in carjackings because, as we can tell from the news accounts, it's much more evenly distributed across the city. Now, nonetheless, it is clearly a challenge. I don't think that we know what exactly is driving this, and so I think that makes it hard to know what the solution is. I can tell you three hypotheses that I've heard without claiming we haven't been able to get any data to understand this, but I'll tell you the hypotheses that I've heard from talking to police officers and others. So one hypothesis is that there has been a change in either the rules or the practices of CPD around chases. That's one hypothesis. So that's not to say that CPD should necessarily reverse their chase policies, because those are themselves dangerous. But this is a hypothesis that I've heard. A second hypothesis that I've heard is that there's been some sort of change within the juvenile justice system and how they handle cases like this in particular. Because one thing that you hear from police officers is that the carjackings is very disproportionately driven by juveniles. I don't know if that's true either, but that's a hypothesis that I've heard. And the third hypothesis that I've heard is some general difficulty around either charging or getting convictions for people who are caught in stolen cars. Now, again, I don't claim to know whether any of those three things are true, but I think this is a very important thing for us to figure out as a city as quickly as we can.
Okay, we'll try to get as many of these answers as questioned. This is from Michael Allen. What contributes to such low clearing rates for gun crimes in Chicago? How does our rate compare to other cities?
Our clearance rate is not great. Our clearance rate is not great. Our clearance rate is, at least two different ways to calculate the clearance rate. I won't bore you with the difference, but I think, at least one commonly used way to calculate our clearance rate is for homicides, it's on the order of maybe 35%, I think is the number that I remember for 2017, or put differently, about one in three homicides result in an arrest. And for non-fatal shootings, our clearance rate, I think the numbers that I remember on the order of, say, 5 to 7%. You did not mishear me. That is 5 to 7%. Or put differently, roughly speaking, 19 out of every 20 people who shoot someone else in the city of Chicago who survives go on to get away with it. Now, one of the intriguing, the other city for which I've seen homicide clearance rate most recently is Los Angeles, and they're on the order of 70 or 75%, if I remember the news reports correctly. And so that raises the question, to which I don't know the answer, is whether the higher clearance rate in Los Angeles is due, at least in part, to that increase in community approval of the police. I don't know, but I think that's an important hypothesis for us to know more about.
Okay, this is from Kimball Layden with Safe Haven IF Prevent. Would you support mandatory work programs for everyone on probation and parole as a way of teaching job skills and monitoring people to ensure that they stay out of trouble moving forward?
Yeah, let me focus on maybe the most interesting part of that. Well, there are many interesting parts of the question, but one interesting part is the question of whether a work program for someone on probation or parole needs to be mandatory. So one of the things that is, I think the whole idea of a mandatory work program starts from the presumption that people who are coming out of the criminal justice system aren't interested in working. And so, one of the interesting things that you see when different cities around the country have done things like subsidized jobs programs for people coming out of prison is that the take-up rate is amazing. The take-up rate is amazing. You see no evidence in the data that people coming out of prison don't want to work. You offer them a subsidized job, and the take-up rate is, 80 or 90%. The challenge that we see is not the willingness of people coming out of prison to work. It's that when the subsidized job ends, their labor market involvement rates just plummet, which is, this is a population, they're coming out of prison, they've got a prison record, they have a often a long history of disadvantages in school, in the labor market, and so many other dimensions of life. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard for them to reintegrate into the labor market and get an unsubsidized job. So I think it's more about, you can see it's not the mandatory part of it that I think that's the challenge.
Okay. Obviously, there are a lot of questions.
Yep.
We're never going to get to most of them, but this is from Susan Snyder. What effect do you think the decrease in stop and frisk has led to the spike in crime in Chicago, or at least contributed to it?
Yeah. Oh, great. A nice non-controversial question. That's excellent.
It's the City Club, you know. We walk right down the middle.
You know, when we booked this, we said we would end at 112. Is that... No. No, I think, One of the things that you see in the data is a very sharp drop in the number of street stops that the Chicago Police Department was carrying out at the end of 2015, very coincident in time to the big increase in gun violence. And so I think that raises the hypothesis that the change in at least that one measure of that some sort of change in proactive policing by CPD might have contributed to the increase in gun violence. I think that the whether that's what's going on is not exactly clear, because as many of you in the room will know, a few years ago in New York City, a judge required the NYPD to dramatically reduce the number of stops that they carry out, and we didn't see a big increase in homicides in New York. Now, Chicago is different from New York, and you know, you could imagine the effects could be different across the cities, but I think it's not clear what the cause and effect is. I think, I believe that the number of street stops has not changed very much in Chicago over 2017 relative to 2016, and yet we're seeing this decline in homicides and shootings in the city of Chicago. So whatever role changes in street stops have played in contributing to the increase, and I don't think we know, it hasn't been a reversion to doing lots of street stops, as far as we can tell in the data, that is causing the declines that we're seeing.
Okay, two last questions. This is from Laura Davis with the League of Women Voters. Does the University of Chicago Crime Lab have statistics yet from the Roseland Triage Center concerning the reduction of jail or ER admits?
No, unfortunately, we don't.
Okay, no, we've answered that. Excellent. Last question. And I apologize to everybody else, but CPS has seen its graduation rate increase from roughly 59% in 2012 to 77% in the last school year. Shouldn't this be helping lower violence numbers, or is it that we're still not reaching the 5,000 high-risk people who drive the problem?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think that I think that is the I think that there is a you know, if you think about what education policy usually focuses on, education policy is usually judged by things like average test scores in a school system or overall graduation rates. So if you think about, like, the bell curve of how kids do in school, if I can drop a little statistics on you at 1:15 in the afternoon after a big lunch, if you think about the bell curve of how kids are doing in school, most education policy is about trying to move the mass of that bell curve to the good direction, higher test scores, higher graduation rates. But I think if you think about where the 5,000 people are who are at disproportionately high risk for gun violence involvement, those are the kids who've been left behind by so many institutions and everything else in society. And I think that's going to require a very concerted effort within these larger education reform efforts to make sure that they're not slipping through the cracks and getting the help they need.
Great. Let's give Dr. Ludwig a big round of applause.